Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Making end-of-life health care decisions can be as uncomfortable as it is necessary. It's never easy to discuss the end stage of life, but on today's program, we'll learn why it's so important, how to do it, and why young people should think about it, too. This is National Healthcare Decisions Day, which is actually part of a dedicated week, and it's designed to encourage those difficult conversations. In studio to discuss the issues are Virginia Rice, an elder law attorney with the Rice Law Firm. Brian Carpenter is a clinical psychologist and professor in the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at Washington University. Both are members of the Gateway End of Life Coalition, which works to promote high-quality end-of-life care for patients and their families. Thank you both so much for being here. It's nice to have you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jenny, let me begin with you. Bucket lists are a popular thing these days, but what we're talking about today is something that normally doesn't wind up on the bucket list, but perhaps should.
Yes, it should. Yeah. Definitely should. If you're talking about bucket lists in terms of the legal documentation, which in my opinion, every individual should have, a durable power of attorney for health care. They should have a health care directive. They should have a durable power of attorney for financial matters. They should also have some forms that are a little more detailed with regard to who they want to receive information with regard to the HIPAA and who they want to actually make their decisions for them if they're unable to with regard to their burial, the services, those type of things that are something that can be pre-planned so that they're done the way that the individual wants them to be done.
Brian, why is this so difficult for so many people to confront?
Well, you know, the idea of a bucket list is really appealing because it does tell you that people are thinking that their life is going to end and they've got some things they want to accomplish before it does. But they don't necessarily go the next step to think, well, there is going to be a time in my life when I am dying before I'm dead. And there are certain things that people want that to look like and don't want that to look like. But even thinking about it can be challenging for people. And certainly talking about those that time of life can be very challenging for people.
Who should they be talking to?
Primarily their family, their friends, and their healthcare providers, the physicians that they expect will be involved in their care at the end of their life, but also the family members and their friends who they think might be close by, might be called into action to help them make decisions if they can't make them for themselves.
But Jenny, we're talking about some legal documentation here too, so I guess an attorney should be part of the process.
Definitely the attorney should be part of the process. Most often people don't like to discuss these issues, but obviously a lot of people realize they need to get a will and try to get things in order so that they make things easier for their family members. And that's where we begin with the discussion of what is it that you really want? Who do you really want to make that decision? If you don't make these decisions yourself, someone that is a complete stranger, a court-appointed guardian, may be making those for you. Typically, people want to make their own decisions, and you don't want to wait till you're incapacitated, you're unable to do so then. So we try to promote pre-planning and talk about these things in depth.
I mentioned in the introduction that it's probably a pretty good idea to be thinking about this long before you reach that stage where the end of life is something that you can contemplate very realistically.
Very true. I mean, we all expect and hope that we might have a long life, but that doesn't happen for anyone. There can be some sort of tragedy or serious illness that befalls anybody at any age. And so these are kinds of conversations and preparations that are important for people to make no matter how old they are.
Well, a lot of folks, I suspect, think, well, I've got a will, you know, I'm covered, right? That's not enough.
That's great for your stuff, but it doesn't necessarily cover your body. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about having conversations and completing documents that provide some instruction about what you want the end of your life to look like, how you want to be taken care of, where you want to be, who you want to be involved, and what kinds of things you do and don't want done to your body at the end of your life.
Jenny, can we be more specific about that, about some of the things that Brian has just mentioned here? Specifically, what are we talking about?
Well, there's a number.
Pulling the plug, in the vernacular.
I don't think we have enough time within this whole day to talk about the issues that surround pulling the plug. However, you know, we do have certain rights that are set forth in statute, and one of the rights that we have is to create what's called a healthcare directive, in which we tell our treating physicians, hospitals, nurses, what it is that we want, or more importantly, what we don't want. And so there are a number of forms that you'll find on the Gateway End of Life Coalition that will help you walk through these questions of what is it that I want, what is it that I don't want, and then you sit down with your lawyer and you talk to them about, I want a healthcare directive, and in this healthcare directive, this is what I'm wanting. I want a durable power of attorney for healthcare so someone else can make these decisions for me if I'm unable to make them myself.
A designated person, obviously.
But that's correct. Again, there's a right of sepulcher, and it's really important. What that means is the right that someone has to make the decisions with regard to what happens to you upon death. Many people do not address that issue. That is where a lawyer like me comes in, because now we've got litigation, and people change after someone they love died. So being able to tell your family, to help your family understand what it is so the transition is smooth, so things are done, so that your wishes are honored, is one of the most important things that I think a lot of people don't realize when they're, you know, contemplating, well, why should I do these documents?
How specific does it get?
It can be extremely specific, and it can be extremely general. There are free forms. Everyone should have a durable power of attorney for healthcare. Everyone should have a healthcare directive. The forms are easily accessible. If you go to the Gateway Coalition for End of Life, they are have many, many links to the different areas in which you can find these forms. They're free. Missouri Bar has these documents also, with very, very good explanations about what it is that you are signing and why. Illinois, by the way, also has a form that can be completed for Illinois residents, and it indeed is also quite explanatory and is very helpful for individuals who just are not sure what they're doing.
Brian, Jenny brings up a point that it's different from state to state, I would have to guess.
It is. There are different forms for each state, so it's important for people to know what the proper forms are in their particular state. I would say that, you know, to emphasize what Jenny's saying, that this all begins with a conversation, that people need to have a conversation with their families, their friends, their physicians about what's important to them. Mm. And to your point about how specific these forms can be, they can be very, very specific, but no matter how specific a form is, it's never going to be able to anticipate all the possible situations a person might find themselves in, which is why it's so important to designate that proxy or that delegate. Because even if you haven't articulated how you would want to be treated in a particular situation, if you've got that delegate, at least that person is there to express your wishes.
And if you don't, let's say a person is very, very sick and perhaps at the very, very end of life, and none of this has happened, who's making those decisions? Is it a physician, an attending physician, or is it law? What's going on?
It's usually a combination of the physician and any next of kin that they can locate, and there's a hierarchy written into the state legislation about who the physician should be going to first, and then next, if there aren't these documents in place.
The issue with regard to who is the person that is the legal decision maker when it comes to these healthcare decisions, unless we have an extreme emergency, that person should be laid out in the documents of which we've discussed. Mm-hmm. However, if there is not that person Often I will see, well, there'll be two family members, and they do not agree on the health care that their mother or father is supposed to receive. That's when the lawyers get involved, and that's when we have to go to court to have somebody that's named as a guardian to make those decisions. That's why these documents are so important, because nobody wants to have their children or loved ones fighting about the care that should be provided. And that's why you want to talk to your family. That's why you want to ensure that your loved ones and other people that care for you are aware of what it is that you want, to avoid litigation.
You know, I understand the weight of the documents and the formal documents that have been signed, but I'm thinking in terms of the situation in which there are no documents.
Correct.
And if you've had a parent has had a conversation with a child and said, I want to be cremated, or I want this, or I want that. Does that carry enough weight if there are two children involved and said, well, I never had that conversation with mom?
If we're coming down to legal, from the legal perspective, if you have named someone in your durable power of attorney for health care that you want to make those decisions for you after your death, you have to identify them, and you must ensure that that durable power of attorney for healthcare, that you've been declared incapacitated for that right of sepulcher to function. So in my office, we have two different forms. We have our durable power of attorney for healthcare, and that allows someone else to make healthcare decisions for you. But we also have a form in which we specifically designate the individual that's going to have this right of sepulcher or right to make these decisions, and what decisions that the individual that's writing it want to have made for them.
Brian, again, I understand the value and the necessity of the forms. But what I'm trying to get at is, if there are no forms, to determine and prove to people listening why it's important to have those forms. What happens if you don't have them? And whom does the presiding physician believe? The daughter who's had the conversation with mom, or the other one?
That leaves everybody in a really awkward position not to have these documents completed. And there's often a negotiation among the people involved, the physicians. If there's a legal team involved, then they're going to be telling us what the statute dictates. I think having had a conversation at least with another person about your wishes, even if you haven't fulfilled the documents, that could be something that people could use.
It carries some weight.
It carries some weight, but it's much better to have these things executed, as we've said.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Yeah.
But what I'm trying to establish is what happens if you don't. And that's the incentive to actually sign the form.
Exactly.
And see a lawyer.
Right.
If I might, in my experience, and again, this is just practical experience, if you have a family and everybody is together, you know, with regard to what is important with regard to the healthcare, the doctors, nurses, social workers, family work as a team to come up with, you know, what is the appropriate, you know, action that should be taken. Usually, again, the family has to agree, though. And again, if there's no document, the statute does say who is the individual that is the first person in line to be able to make those, you know, after-death decisions. But, you know, again, typically, I don't know about you, Brian, if you've seen that, but family members that are very cohesive work with the medical professionals to, you know, move forward when those types of documents are not in place.
I want to pick up on that point. We have to take a break. Let's do that now. We're talking about end-of-life health care decisions, and we'd like to get your take on that. Perhaps you've been in this position, have a story you'd like to share with us, or questions you'd like to ask about it. My guests in studio are Virginia Rice, an elder law attorney with the Rice Law Firm. Also with us is Brian Carpenter, a professor in the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at Washington University. And they are also members of the Gateway End-of-Life Coalition. Back to we'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Virginia, let me come back to you. We're talking about family in the conversation. What if there is no family?
I often address that situation. when my clients come in and they have no family, we try to find close personal friends that have listened to them, that they're able to discuss these issues about, and who really truly understand them. Perhaps there may be a close individual in their church, a friend, lifelong friend, or something that, along those lines. We always want to have a couple of individuals in case, you know, one individual is unable to fulfill the role as what we call agent. In fact, that there's somebody that then can take that over that role. Oftentimes, individuals will have to name even their attorney that they have had for a very, very long time because there is no one else that they have that knows what they want and will honor those wishes. So that happens often, but not very frequently.
Brian, let me turn to another issue that I'm sure surfaces fairly frequently these days, and that is the question of dementia and the person who is reaching this stage and dealing with that. Does that come up often, and how is it dealt with?
It does, and that's it raises an interesting complication because when people have dementia, as the disease progresses, it will make it more difficult for them to express their own wishes. So it's important for individuals to execute these kinds of advanced care planning documents as early as possible in the disease process when they can contribute and express their preferences, so that at least as the disease progresses, they've got some documentation. It can become very complicated later in the stages of the disease unless people have articulated their preferences in these kinds of documents.
Jenny, anything to add to that? Yeah, I mean, you have to determine at what point the dementia became present and when these decisions were made.
One issue I think that's really important is that, you know, dementia is not static. So you'll have times when somebody's doing well and then not so well. When somebody is aware of the natural bounty of their estate and can make legal decisions, that is absolutely the time in which those documents, the healthcare documents, should be executed. Often we will talk to the treating physician to ensure that the documents that my clients sign, they are aware of from a medical perspective and can sign those.
I think one of the complicating factors is that sometimes we talk about these documents as if once you've filled them out, then it's done. And that's really not how it needs to work, because when people experience important changes in their life, for example, they experience a new serious illness, they may watch the death of an important other person in their life, they may have a change in their relationship status, all these documents need to be revisited from time to time to make sure that they're current.
We have some people want to get into this discussion, but this email from Terry says, my mother had what I thought was an ironclad health care directive until she went into the hospital. Even with her standard DNR and a list of things she did not want done to prolong her life, the hospital informed me that it wasn't enough and that they had other various ways to keep her alive against her wishes. How do you deal with a situation like that?
My response, of course, is going to be you need to call a lawyer. But, you know, that's something that takes some time. I would ask that they take it up to the ethics board within the hospital. That is just not something that is ethically appropriate for the doctor and they need to go above whomever the treating physician is.
That's a lot to ask when someone that's close to is dying. Mm-hmm. They have to go through that sort of process.
Well, the other process could be to move them to a different hospital, which I would think would be much more dramatic. Again, that is the right of the doctor to refuse. I do not see that happen very often, but it can materialize.
Terry goes on to say that she suggests anyway that hospitals will skirt sometimes the standard health care directive. Have you ever heard of that? I mean, seems to me with all these legal documents that we're talking about that should not be happening.
You know, you're right. I think Terry's raising an important question about how kind of comprehensive we need to be thinking about this subject across all levels. So it's important for private citizens to have executed these documents, but it's also important for our healthcare institutions and the people who work in those institutions to understand the goals here. It's also important from a public policy and a governmental point of view that we have institutions in place to respect these documents if we're telling people they need to fill them out.
But it all comes back to the documents. You got to have that as a starting point, mm-hmm. No question. Let's take a call or two as time will allow. We'll bring in Madonna calling from Crestwood. Madonna, thank you for calling and waiting. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm calling about the end-of-life documents. Is there any concern that my documents may contain instructions that would run contrary to the religious strictures of some of our local religious-affiliated hospitals, and then therefore not be followed in that instance?
I think that's possible, and you want to be very careful about choosing the providers that you're selecting for your health care and the places where you're going to be receiving that health care. I don't believe that it's a requirement that a physician or a health care facility necessarily follow restrictions if they're counter to their own personal or religious beliefs. So people need to be conscientious about choosing their providers and where they get their health care.
If I might add, statutorily, a doctor or a hospital cannot impede an individual's right or the agent in fact's right to move the patient to a location in which the patient's wishes will be honored and, in fact, should be facilitating that move.
To this point, I think Rachel in St. Louis might raise an issue that will certainly come into play these days. Rachel, go ahead. You're on the air.
So with marriage equality and everything, this has helped. But one of the problems that I saw as a law school student helping people draft wills and other things as a pro bono effort was that LGBT, if you don't name that person, you could end up with maybe your estranged parents or somebody who's adverse to what your wishes are. Maybe you've been separated from them for years, and all of a sudden they're going to be the ones making your end-of-life decisions. So even with a marriage and those kind of things, you should still, I recommend, as now I'm a lawyer, but before we would always recommend, even if you are married under the law, that you should take the time to do those documents, even if you think, well, my wife or my husband will take care of this.
Go ahead, Jenny.
I think, you know, when we are overall looking at that particular issue, it's important for anyone to ensure that they name the person that they trust, that they've spoken with, that you know loves them, and is able to do the things that you want done. Very frustrating, obviously, for someone that you loved, whether married or not, is and who you trust, will not be in a quote-unquote legal position to be able to make those decisions. There are avenues, if time allows, to go to court and have a guardian and conservator appointed, but those are time-consuming. So it's very important to make sure that you're talking to your health professionals about what it is that you want, that you disseminate these documents so that the doctors, the hospitals, your dentist, anyone that you come in contact with, if you go to the same hospital, I recommend that my clients ensure that's in their medical record. It's important to disseminate those documents.
Brian, another issue that many people are talking about today concerns death with dignity, mm-hmm. assisted suicide. How does this come into play in making plans? I mean, I guess state to state, or depending.
Exactly right. Things are changing very rapidly around the United States right now. There are several states where people do have more control over the circumstances of their death. Missouri is not one of those states at this point, but there's been several states where that's changed in the last couple mm-hmm. of years. I think this is another example of how the conversation in our country country is shifting a little bit around the issues around death, and that people are understanding that that's an important phase of a person's life, and we should have some say in what that looks like. And that can go in different directions depending on how people feel about it.
Sure. Jenny, any thoughts on that? Do you run across this in your work?
Certainly. I see quite a bit of it. You know, the issue is, how do you define death with dignity? And we have the means in Missouri, anyway, with which we can say what it is that we want prior to getting into a situation that is critical. However, we still do not have any legislation that allows an individual to make the decision to end their life prior to perhaps the natural cause of death. And that is something that is a very hot ethical issue, and that is why we hope that the legislature will be addressing these issues. I know there are many advocates, and you know, those issues are on the table right now as we speak.
You know, Don, if I might jump in, I think one of the misconceptions that people have about some of these documents is that they're afraid that they will be used to withdraw treatment or deny them treatment, and that's actually the exact opposite. That these are documents that are important because they allow people to express what they would not want, but also what they would want.
Yeah, right. We're going to have to wrap this up, but in this context, we have a tweet here. Has social media ever been used with the statements of another person to determine a person's wishes? This is today's world.
I am not aware of that happening. However, it would be good evidence, should one need to go to a court of law to decide these issues or to decide who a guardian is, because that intent has been noted. It's evidence.
It's better than nothing.
Yes, absolutely.
Better than nothing. We're going to have to end it there. A very informative discussion. Thank you so much, Jenny Rice and Brian Carpenter, for being with us. A reminder, a special art exhibit, we wanted to get to that, is underway throughout the rest of the day at St. Luke's Hospital on Woods Mill Road. I should have brought this up during our conversation. It's to promote the end-of-life conversation, so folks can go out there and get involved a little more heavily than we did today. But thank you so much for being with us. Great
thank
to see you.
You
guys. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.